Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Everybody, welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Tilford.
Josh Brown, how you feeling?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I thought we'd talk about The Last of Us, because me and you have been playing The Last of Us Part 2 Remastered, or whatever the hell they're calling it these days, and we thought we'd weigh in on that. So we're going to do a whole chunk on both of us playing Last of Us 2 Remastered, and then we thought we'd have a chat on the state of The Last of Us in 2024. Should people buy The Last of Us 2 Remastered?
It depends.
It depends on many things.
Really depends. You know, this isn't in the same vein as The Last of Us Part 1, which was the proper remake of the original Last of Us. And that, to me, had a higher barrier for entry because we already had The Last of Us remastered on PS4. That was already available. It was a pretty good remaster. And that remake didn't add too much, yet it was going for a premium price point. This is a much easier sell, in my opinion. It's only £39 at the time of recording in the UK. It's a $10 upgrade if you already own The Last of Us Part 2. And for those $10, if we're, you know, criticizing it on that, I think it is, you know, definitely worth the upgrade because of the extra features that are added on that we're definitely going to get into.
We'll break everything down because I think one of the biggest things with this was like, exactly what am I getting for my $10, my £10 or whatever. And the thing is, like, I hate having to split all the hairs of resolution stuff. And like, even this morning when I was talking to you, I was like, how the hell do we nail this stuff down? Excuse me. But we do have, you know, The Last of Us 2's version that you can currently play on PS5 is the PS4 version, which was the PS4 Pro version that was then on the PS5. Yeah. And that had a locked 1440p resolution with an uncapped frame rate. So the new version, Last of Us 2 Remastered, is now going for a native 4K output in fidelity mode and 1440p upscale to 4K in performance mode with an unlocked frame rate depending on what TV you have.
God.
So I just put it in performance mode all the time now.
Sound like a Digital Foundry doing this?
I guess
we're just as smart.
That's just where we are now. It's
just
like
as smart.
Breaking it all down. But yeah, like you said, it's only a $10, £10 upgrade. I think for me, the immediate go-to was like, okay, how much of you actually remastered? And I, like, you know, side by side, can't really tell the difference. Like, I think you'd have to really get Digital Foundry about it to make them a verb and to make that stuff work and go like, okay, they've literally like cleaned this up slightly. But we're talking about a difference of a 1440p resolution to a 4K resolution, and my brain can't do that anyway.
My brain, at least, it's tricked itself into believing it can, because when I was playing this in the fidelity mode, just to clarify, I haven't actually played the entirety of the story again. I've just done a little bit, done the encounters.
Yes.
Played the roguelike mode that we're going to talk about, the lost levels, stuff like that. So it's not a comprehensive thing. But even from that experience, like, to me, I can see those upgrades. The 4K native resolution just makes everything a little bit more crisp. The level of detail is a little bit higher. Yeah, it's not an essential upgrade if you've already played The Last of Us 2 to death, especially on the PlayStation 5. But if you're new to it, I think you will appreciate just how good it looks, or at least I did. I got a funny story. I was playing through the lost levels yesterday, and there's one that's set in a sewer.
We should super quick say that the lost levels are the three in-progress levels that were added to this package. It's almost like a deleted scenes thing, but you can actually control them and walk through them, and there's developer commentary that you can trigger.
Absolutely.
And
I've got a lot to say about those later on, actually, funny enough, because surprise, surprise, I love them. But yeah, I was in one of these sewer levels, and I literally turned to my girlfriend and said, "This is the best-looking sewer I've ever seen." And that's not even a finished level. You know, I was just looking at the light and the way it bounced in HDR mode, and I was thinking, maybe life doesn't get better than this sewer.
Oh, no, I can't. God, you know, when we were, I knew when we were going through it that I was just like, oh my God, I knew that we were going to clash a bit on these. Because like, I love the idea of delving into the, obviously the reality of development and showing us in progress stuff. I wish that all studios did that. I wish there was in progress versions of everything. Show the reality of making a game, highlight all that stuff. And the human cost that goes into that stuff, considering where over 10,000 people lost their jobs last year. It was just that every single one of these is over in like 5 minutes max. Like, yeah. I was like, they're nice to see. And I like you get Neil Druckmann's intro for each one. And then you get the specific art director or the person who worked on the level has something to say about each level. They're really cool in that regard. But I think it's worth pointing out that you shouldn't necessarily go into this package going, that's what's going to get my money's worth. I think it's an overall thing. Like, I think they're neat to see. But like I said, they're over super quick. The three of them, just to outline what they are. One of them is a party that takes place. It's a party that takes place in Jackson, but it's like an outdoor party, and it would have been treated as a flashback towards the end of the game. There's another one, which is the sewers, like you mentioned, which is set when Ellie falls into like the really strong current towards the middle of the game. And they originally had just a sewer level, which I was like, we've had a million of them. To me, that was nothing. And then the third one is another timeline jump. I think it's meant to be set after the Dina Abbey scene.
Yeah.
And we would cut to some point in the future where Ellie's hunting a boar and she kills it really gorily, and it's really unceremonious and whatever. But yeah, back to you.
I think, you know, not saying that you were going in with this mindset, but if you are going into The Last of Us 2 Remastered, looking forward to those lost levels because you are expecting more The Last of Us Part 2 peak quality gameplay. Like, no, don't expect that. Like, they were cut for a reason.
Yeah, they
after
were always
all.
Cut levels. Yeah.
You know, they were cut levels. They're unfinished. You know, like you said in the introduction video for them, like, it's explained that some things don't have assets. There's often no voice lines, no animations, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But for me, I was coming into The Last of Us 2 Remastered, mostly looking forward to not playing the game again, but getting that look behind the scenes because you fascinated me last year by telling me about, you know, the Atari collection that you played, where, like you were saying, you know, you were getting these in-depth looks at games that were in production. And for me, playing through those lost levels, listening to the director's commentary, I realized how few bonus features we ever get in the realm of video games. Like, they were so standardized in the realm of movies. And when I was growing up, like, I learned so much about how you make a film from looking at those behind the scenes featurettes or listening to director's commentaries, right?
Massively.
And this is going to sound like a bit, but I learned so much about filmmaking and camera movements from the commentary on the American Pie DVD.
If only that was the first time I'd heard that.
Then I did like probably 4 years of film school. I'm exaggerating, of course, but like the way they talked about camera movements and stuff, I obviously wouldn't have known that, and it was really informative. Similarly, I know very little about video game production, so listening to the creators talk about why a section was cut, whether it was for pacing issues, whether they just couldn't get the gameplay right, to me, that was fascinating. Mm. Whether or not you think that's worth the extra $10, I don't know. For me, it was, because obviously I'm a big The Last of Us Part 2 fanboy anyway, and getting an insight into what could have been and how you make those decisions in game dev is something that feels so rare outside of the NoClip documentaries or a few other featurettes that are out there. And to me, that part of the experience is what I was looking forward to the most.
No, dude, like, by far, this is a step in the best direction. Like, that's why I keep highlighting Atari 50. The making of Karateka is another one. The work that Digital Eclipse are doing, they've got an upcoming one coming out on, I think it's on, is it Jordan Mechner? He's the dude that was just in making Karateka. But either way, you've got all of these deep dives into certain projects, interviewing the people behind them, showing in progress things. In the case of some of the Atari stuff, it's like versions of games that were made when a dude was in high school that eventually got to the one that came out. Just really fascinating stuff. And like you said, the gaming industry is always so buttoned up and NDA'd and everything, and you never get to see the reality of making these games, especially at the Naughty Dog level.
Yeah.
So it definitely scratches that itch. It was just that for me, because it's one of the main things they advertise, is like, pay for The Last of Us 2 Remastered because you're getting these extra levels.
Yeah.
It's worth just clarifying exactly what they are.
Absolutely.
Like, I kind of expected them to just be like nav meshes, like they wouldn't even have textures or anything, and they're in between the two. But like you said, animations aren't finished on some stuff, but they do highlight some ideas they had. Like in the party scene, there was a thing where you would use your the weapon crafting ability to like mix drinks, and then Ellie would walk around with a drink as she's talking to people. But then they couldn't necessarily make that work because she'd have to put it down for other animations. And it's like, that's a cute, like a fun little thing to add on. I do think that I guess we can go through the other ones, because there's, what do you think of the hunting the boar one?
Honestly, right, I can already tell from your tone and maybe your face, but I played through that, got to the end, and I won't spoil everything that happens, but there's a little story beat that happens right at the end of it, and I again turned to my girlfriend and went, I wish that was in the final game.
Right.
You know, I thought they were really onto something there that was impactful emotionally, though, even though mechanically, like they even admit in the commentary for that level, they couldn't quite get it to work. So I see why it was cut, but it was that was the only one where I thought, this is a real shame, because this would have, for me anyway, maybe benefited to the impact of that section. But I'm not a game developer. I don't know. Just as a fan, that's what I thought.
Yeah, for me, it's like I have a wider problem with just how The Last of Us feels as an IP. And we're going to talk about that later in the podcast after this video goes up and everything. As my throat fails on me. Yet again. No, the thing is with the feel of The Last of Us, especially since part two, it's just been like, how can we just do the most horrific bottomed out tone possible? And I know that overall there's a lot of light in there too. And I've always made that point about The Last of Us too. But I feel like as it's gotten bigger and like the conversations around it and how sort of, like I said, just sort of morally flat it kind of tends to be, or like a tonally fly kind of, it feels like this level was just like, oh my God, okay, we'll do it again. We're going to do this really horrible thing. And obviously the way the director is describing it is that we wanted it to be completely unceremonious and it's based around a kill and whatever. It's like, yeah, of course. It's like Last of Us 101 at this point. And I can see why you cut it, basically, was my thing. And after I played through it, I was like, I'm glad you didn't do that. Because that would have been even more on the nose than the rest of the game was.
It's Last of Us 2 101. I would argue against it being a kind of mission statement for the overall franchise. You know, right from the start, we knew famously or infamously, The Last of Us Part 2 was about hate. It was about being in those murky, horrible shades of morality that you described there. So to know that this boss sequence was originally part of it, I was like, right, that makes sense considering the themes that you're going for. You know, I don't think, at least in my opinion, that it's indicative of the, you know, direction of the franchise as a whole. Just this one game and one project.
Totally. I'm being entirely subjective. I'm just talking about where Last of Us is in 2024, where I'm at, you know, playing through it, seeing it go from this one game in 2013 to this huge thing now with the TV show and the all the GIFs that blew up across the weekend where everyone realized they got sick of all the GIFs that are out there on Twitter and everything. We should talk about what I think is the meat of the why you should spend the money on this thing, which is the no return mode. It's the roguelike mode. It's very interesting to see God of War do one as well.
Yeah.
It made me think in a more conspiratorial, wider Sony sense that they maybe had all of these modes ready for some sort of online thing, some sort of live service thing. If you're Jim Ryan before he was stepping down, going like, we should have some more live service stuff, why not make a live service Last of Us, a live service God of War, get people paying for all the skins you can unlock, the roguelike modes, and monetize that stuff. It just wouldn't surprise me. I don't believe that Sony Santa Monica and Naughty Dog both came up with this at the same time. I think it was a wider company directive, and because that entire wing of Sony's now falling apart, Last of Us multiplayer has been cancelled, and we're getting these modes rolled out. All of that is to say this is a very, very solid mode.
Yes.
It's just interesting the way that it's rolled out.
No, I'd absolutely agree. You know, we don't have any information about whether this was intended to be a live service right now. But for instance, every time you finish one of the levels and you go back to what is essentially your base, I did laugh that you more or less open a loot box.
Yes.
Like, it's not randomized, the stuff inside, but you are opening a box, you're getting a bunch of currency.
They could have randomized it.
Well, that's it. It did make me think, At a certain point, could you have monetized that currency that you get to make for more efficient runs? I don't know. That's being very cynical. You know, there's no real evidence about that. It's just kind of the feel that you get.
Yeah.
Like you said, lumping it in with the rest of the live service attitude from Sony over the past few years. But yeah, the mode itself, that was the one I was looking forward to the most. Mm-hmm. Because while I haven't dabbled in God of War Valhalla like I know you have...
Yes.
And again, I'm going to make an outrageous statement. I've always loved The Last of Us Part 2's combat. Mm. I think it's as good as any third person combat system out there. Ooh. In terms of just its impact, its weight, its fluidity. Like, honestly, to me, man...
I'm not denying it. No, yeah.
To me, it's Max Payne 3, and it's The Last of Us Part 2.
I'm doing a face there. That's a die core.
And I think that
I was with you for a while, but I don't know.
Incredible in the way that they prioritize... animation.
I've never been in a room when a crime's committed. Okay.
Animation and weight and impact. And nothing makes me feel more on the back foot and improvisational than The Last of Us Part 2's combat, right? So I thought, if you just give me a gauntlet of that, I'll love it. I don't think, and I went a little bit Geordie there, I didn't think it, that it is the mode that I wanted it to be. But again, for $10, I'm having a lot of fun with it. I enjoy unlocking the new characters, and the combat in 60 frames per second especially is silky smooth and better than it's ever been.
It's worth saying that the structure is like a handful of levels. I think it's like four levels and then a boss fight.
Six
levels and then a boss fight. You're going back to a home base. You're sort of, getting different equipment and stuff and going back out, having another run. And there are tons of characters to play as. Like, you can't unlock Joel, but there's like a multi-step thing to get to him. Because it's kind of, you start with Ellie and Abby, and then you have both sides of their story based on who you then unlock. Like, Ellie gets you Dina, which I think then gets you Jesse, which then gets you Joel. There's maybe someone in between.
Yeah, maybe.
But it's a multi-step thing anyway. Either way, you start with Ellie and Abby and you work your way forward.
Tommy's in between.
Tommy, there you go. Everyone other than Joel. I only wanted to play as Joel, and he wouldn't let me play as Joel. And so there's that. You've got to unlock him in the guitar mode as well, but we'll get there. The overall mode, though, is just a really good showcase of the combat. And I remember just before Last of Us 2 came out, when they would show off the gameplay trailers, there was that whole thing amongst a whole bunch of devs and general fan reaction going, there's no way that it plays that well. There's no way that you can transition between aiming at someone and then ducking through a bookshelf or bookcase and then shooting someone else and whatever. You totally can. Obviously, we played it back in 2020, but it is a beautiful combat system. I'm not with you that it's up there with Max Payne 3 or like Gears 2 or something, but still, it's a beautiful thing. We'll find out later in the week if it leaks in the Xbox thing. But still, it is beautifully put together, and this is a really fun showcase of that. You do have lots of access to mod upgrades and different weapons, grenades and everything. It's just a fun way to tear through a ton of people. And you get loads of skin unlocks. There's a really cool one for Abby with a leather jacket that looks awesome. There's some good stuff in here. So I think it's if you like roguelike structures, for me, it gets a bit repetitive in terms of just the levels themselves aren't... They're fine, but it's I think for me, because of the amount of roguelikes that we've had, and if you draw a whole spectrum between Rogue Legacy and Hades and things like this and God of War, at some point you're replaying the exact same environment over and over again. It's not entirely procedurally generated. You're just being given one of a certain biome, and then that can feel repetitive, or it does to me after a while.
No, I agree. I wasn't fully expecting, maybe it's on me for not properly researching, I don't know how much is out there, but I wasn't fully expecting just how segmented those levels would feel. Like you said, it's a pretty small area each time, like a segmented version of a combat zone from the main game, and then you're kicked back to the home base, and then you go back again in a new level. What keeps it fresh for me, though, are the mods that you can get on each level, and some of those can get wacky. So these can change the look of a level. It can add thick fog that changes the atmosphere, but also obscures enemies. But you can get really wild ones. I think they showed off on the PlayStation Twitter yesterday the raining Molotov mode where you've got fire explosions raining down, and that in lieu of really unique levels kept things fresh enough for me and is encouraging me to go back to get those further unlocks and see what other custom events they have in store, because there are a few. I think it's just a shame that like you said it starts off really kind of slow and ramps up. Initially when I jumped in, I thought, oh, is this it? Is it just me against nine enemies
and over and over again.
Then we go back and we move on, but then it started to reveal more of itself the more I played.
Some stuff it's worth highlighting as well, that you have different spawn points, obviously different waves of enemies. I had a couple of times where they were just spawning behind me, even though that's where I was. And I was like, I guess over time they might have play tested that more. They might patch it, I guess, going forward. But little things like that, if you keep your head on a swivel, you'll be all right. But it's just little bits like that where maybe a more seasoned multiplayer dev might have thought of those things or able to implement those things.
Yeah.
But I do think, Last of Us 2's multiplayer combat was always brilliant. And this is just a really fun, you can just indulge in it. This is the thing that I would hang the money on. I think that this is the thing that's worth paying the money if you already like Last of Us combat. Because just how visceral it is, and it's just it is a fun chunky combat system, so it's it is almost exactly what you think it is. And like I said, if you've played God of War, it's really surprising how similar they are, in terms of even the hood and everything, in terms of just bringing up here's a list of skins, here's a list of different options for your next run. It's just kind of interesting seeing Sony do this with two franchises at almost exactly the same time.
If you can explain to me the differences or similarities a bit more, because when I heard about God of War Valhalla, obviously everyone was talking about the story content that was involved with that.
That's the best thing in it.
The Last of Us Part 2 doesn't have any story content tied to this mode, but is it similar in the way that you go through levels from the main game, or are they new levels in God of War? What are the differences in terms of the scale of production?
No, that's a really good distinction, because there's no story content in Last of Us 2 that we've seen anyway from the runs that we've done. God of War Valhalla, Ragnarok Valhalla, is new stuff. It's new levels. They do repeat, you are doing the same chunk of area area over and over again.
Right.
And then the story stuff is ostensibly cutscenes that you're getting to eventually, but there's a lot of dialogue between Kratos and Mimir between, you know, every run, like fleshing into what's happened after Ragnarok finished.
Yeah.
It's well done for what it is. I get sick of Mimir, as I did back when we did the review. I was like, dude, stop telling me everything.
He's the best guy.
He's a really good guy, but he spells everything out. I'm like, just pick some of it interpretational, my friend. And but yeah, I think that's the biggest selling point, I guess, with Valhalla, which is ironic because it's a free upgrade. In this case, you are paying the money to get access to it, but there is more to The Last of Us 2, right, remastered as an overall package.
Yeah, that's true.
So you are kind of paying the money for that.
And I suppose you could argue that God of War Valhalla, Ragnarok, yes, was already on PS5 natively as well, whereas totally. This is kind of like an upgrade. I will say that while there isn't like, I think I described it a little bit poorly because it felt like I implied that there was no new content in the roguelike mode. Mm. Like you said, you know, there are new characters which come with voice lines and skins and different play styles. Yeah. Each character plays differently.
Different buffs when they start a run as well.
Yeah, yeah. Like Dina is specced towards crafting. Mm. Ellie's more balanced and it just kind of goes on like that. And there are repurposed levels from the main game that work as in combat encounters here that aren't you. Like, obviously, we all saw Jackson in the original Last of Us Part 2, but we never got a chance to fight in Jackson this time around. We do, so it's not like you are just, you know, going through the encounters that you can already do from the chapter select in the story. It is way more involved than that. I just wanted to kind of clarify that.
No, that's totally worth clarifying. Like I said, I think it is just a really fun indulgence in just combat. And it's distinguishable enough from it. It's just an interesting thing overall as a package for this remaster, because it's like you can see almost exactly what they've done at every step of it. Whereas like for God of War Valhalla, it was like, here's this whole new mode that no one expected. It's all new story content. There's a ton of stuff in there that is brilliant in regards to if you grew up with God of War, if you know like Kratos's journey so far, to keep it as vague as possible, they do right by that. Oh, there's an alarm going off. That's the Last of Us alarm. That said, catch coming for. I don't know what's on the microphones, but it's probably not too bad. But yeah, in regards to this package, we talk about other stuff that's in there and the idea of being able to see the lost levels and the making of stuff. A lot of stuff is gated behind the story completion, which makes sense. You can import your save. I was going to say that before, but I forgot. You can just import your save and just keep going, but it won't class that, as far as I know, as a story completion thing. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So that's good. The way that I did it, maybe I just went in the menus the wrong order or something, but you can't just continue where you were before, which is a good carryover. And they do have a tease in here for the Grounded documentary, which is the overall behind the scenes thing for The Last of Us 2, which I kind of wish was in here if I'm paying the money.
It's
better that that's in a wider sense anyway on
YouTube. It's getting added to the game in a post-launch update, but it is a shame that it isn't there for launch, because like I said, you know, you've already got the director's commentary over the cutscenes in the actual game, and then you've got the lost levels and the commentary behind there. To me, it would have completed that sort of behind the scenes portfolio that you could have got from this game, but it will be coming whenever it releases. Yeah.
It's worth, because I'm just kind of running down the things that they're selling this on. The other one is the guitar mode, which
I haven't played that actually, because I was crapping it. I think I played
the most of it, but it's like the most of us. But it's still the way that this thing controls. It's putting all six strings on the touchpad, so they're very close to each other. And it was the same. It's the same controllability that was in there when you played as Ellie and you like, you're sitting in the cinema and you can mess around and stuff. Except that in this one, it's almost like a photo mode type thing. You can change backgrounds. You can actually change the type of guitar, which is fun. You can get a banjo, an electric guitar. You got to unlock them. You can switch who you're sitting down as. You can play as Joel. You can switch to Gustavo Santaolalla, the composer, which is awesome. And so that's a neat little mode. I wish they'd made it a bit easier to go between the strings, because you end up just sort of catching the other ones. And I think I don't know how they would necessarily have done it.
Yeah.
But still, it's cool to be able to go through so many different chord forms and put little pieces together. It's nice. It's a nice little thing. You can get rid of the hood and just make little songs.
It's someone who can't play a guitar and doesn't really have fingers long enough to do it.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, Visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
What do you mean?
Just wanted to pop you.
Long enough to do it.
Is it like, you know, not an offending experience because you're playing it on a game, you're playing on a touchpad, yeah. But can you, I've seen like, you know, people replicate riffs from famous songs and do it really well and convincingly. Yeah. Is there enough satisfaction from that if you are familiar with the chords for
like,
songs?
As someone who plays guitar a lot, like it's, I want to say two things at once. Like, no, it's nowhere near a real guitar.
Yes.
But two, it is satisfying. Like, yeah, it's fun. I mean, same thing where all the chords are on a wheel, but I think there's more chords in this than there were in the bass game. Mm. But yeah, I mean, you can still, if you're elegant enough with finger pushes, you can play some multi-string riff stuff, and you can put it on electric guitar and whatever, and there's a lot of different like effects for the guitar tone as well. It's just one of those things. It was like when I was going through the lost levels and they were like, oh, we had this mode where you could mix drinks.
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah, like it's the last, sure, like do you not want to spend the time on something else? Like, and then it's in this package, it's like, well, what have we got, guys? Well, Johnny in the corner is doing a guitar mode, we should probably put that in there, you know, make sure it's worth the money.
Yeah, no, I get you, like the guitar mode isn't the system seller, right? Like that's not going to get
it is one of their bullet points,
in.
Though.
No, it is. Yeah. But I do think like this entire package is, if you're buying it new, like if you're buying it for the £40, it's the best way to play The Last of Us Part 2.
Yeah,
it's the best way to experience it, in my opinion. But for the $10 upgrade, I think stuff like the guitar, they're like fan favorites. Yeah, they're more niche, but as a kind of additive thing, like a lot of people got a lot of fun out of that. Like
yeah,
there was
yeah.
a lot
Including
of like
me.
Videos, like I said, that kind of went viral. You know, it's obviously not going to justify the package on its own, but I like that it's in there because they did make that system and just fleshing out a little bit with new characters. It's a fun one. It's it's better than the racetrack they put in Death Stranding, put it that way.
Ranking all the pointless Sony add-ons that have been in all these modes.
Well, should
games.
We? Unless there's any more points we need to get through. Like, where do you think this lands, and do you think it justifies the money? Because for me, this upgrade is somewhere between Ghost of Tsushima's Director's Cut and Death Stranding's Director's Cut. It doesn't have the expansion that Ghost of Tsushima did, but its extras to me are way more appealing than what we got from Death Stranding. And I love both of those games, by the way. I've got both of those upgrades just for the visuals.
Same.
But this time around, I think it's kind of somewhere in the middle. Like I said, if you haven't played The Last of Us Part 2, it's an appealing product.
Yes.
It's justifies the price, I think. And as an upgrade, it's got a bit more meat on its bones than Death Stranding did. And as a look behind the scenes, It easily justifies. I mean, we got a review copy, which we'll no doubt put in the description. But I would have bought it for I would have paid those £10 to get access to those modes.
I don't think I would have paid for it. I think it was one of those things where in the run-up to the launch, it just never really got my attention. I don't think it's essential. I think it's good to have. And if you haven't played through The Last of Us 2, you might as well get this version. But if I'm ranking it, like, or if I'm thinking about those other editions that have come with the other director's cuts, like Ghost of Tsushima had that whole story chapter about Jin's father, which is really, really cool. And I think that's, I don't say it's essential, but it's really, really good to have. Yeah. Death Stranding had that little Metal Gear stealth level that was in there.
That was crap, man.
I was for a Death Stranding attempt at stealth with Kojima going like, hey, Metal Gear, remember Metal Gear? I was like, I remember Metal Gear. That was fun. I think for this, when I think of the meat of the specifics of what I was going in for, what I want to see, the literal word remastered, like we're talking about, for me, splitting hairs on the resolution change. It already looked gorgeous on the PS5 based on the PS4 Pro version.
Yeah.
So I think that's not a knock against it, but it's just getting very honest about what it is to me. And then the lost levels, I think, like I said, they were over in half an hour collectively, and I didn't necessarily enjoy the content that was in them anyway. The no return mode is really cool. I think if you like Last of Us combat, that's worth paying for. But personally, the roguelike stuff, it's just not enough to make me go, like, oh, I want to indulge in this side of it. But it's cool. If you haven't played through The Last of Us 2, this should be where you come in.
Yeah.
But I think if you're on the fence like I wasn't blown away by what actually is here. It's almost exactly what I thought it was.
I'd agree. I think if if you're not itching to go back to The Last of Us 2 anyway, this might not convince you because you already get an exceptional version if you already own a PlayStation 5.
Totally.
But if you haven't played The Last of Us since you played it on the base PlayStation 4, for instance, then it definitely is enough of a jump, I think. You know,
we
were lucky enough to play the original game on PS4 Pro, and then I played it again on PS5, so I've experienced this game a lot in variously upgraded forms. But yeah, I think it's just depends on the context in which you're looking at this game. Like, if you're someone like us who've played a lot of it, probably not worth it. If you're someone who hasn't played it, I'd say definitely worth it. If you're someone who hasn't played it since the original PlayStation 4, I'd also say those graphical improvements are big enough to justify it, because you're now getting 60 frames per second, you're now getting 4K, you're now getting all of these features on top.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say, time to jump in.
Where you are on the state of Last of Us as an IP?
You know I'm a
I know
fan.
Where you are.
You absolutely know
I see him.
Loved the games. I loved the T-shirt? I loved the TV show.
You should get a T-shirt.
I don't want to get a T-shirt. No, I don't know what I would get, you know?
We got a one made by dudes called Pinko, or Pinky rather, one of the Golden Pinko ones, on social media. Dude made us some shirts.
He really did.
Because I used the phrase, the franchising of us, which is how I view the entire IP now.
Well, that's it. Those were excellent shirts, but I don't want to support that sentiment.
I do.
I love The Last of Us being a franchise, a multimedia franchise, and funnily enough, we're recording this the day after the primetime Emmys, where The Last of Us was nominated for a lot and went home with none. This is after, the likes of Nick Offerman won in some other Emmy show that is untelevised. I don't know how those award shows work, but that is it. Anyway, the point is, how do I feel about The Last of Us overall? I feel good about it. I think it's in a nice spot. I'm intrigued as to what comes next. I like that they're at least taking some time between video game installments, and we've got the TV show in the meantime. But yeah, you know I'm hyped on it, Matt.
Yeah, I'm weird on it. I'm sort of like, it's been a weird trajectory where, like, I absolutely adore 2013's Last of Us. It's still one of my favorite games of all time, and was for quite a while after that. It didn't beat Metal Gear Solid on the PS1.
No.
It was up there. And then it's just been kind of fascinating watching it unfold. It took so long to do Last of Us 2, like 7 years. I remember when Nolan North leaked it, and it was just it was the same with Red Dead Redemption. It was just like, feels like a game that doesn't need a sequel.
Yeah.
And then you can argue whatever you want about how valid Red Dead Redemption 2 was. But to me, Last of Us 2 in the same bracket, where it was an immaculately made thing that I didn't need, and it was beautifully done. And then it's been interesting to see it, like, become this huge TV show that everyone was talking about. It was like a big cultural touchstone. And then now we'll get into the TV show stuff, because we've got castings for season 2. Like, we know that Caitlin Dever is going to be Abby, which is really cool, because she was originally considered for Ellie years ago. It's like the Uncharted thing again with Mark Wahlberg. But yeah, The Last of Us IP, it's just kind of been fascinating watching Sony mold it into something far bigger than I would argue it was ever going to be before. I'd love an interview with Bruce Straley years down the line, or someone from Naughty Dog who was there at the time. How much did you guys think this was a big thing?
Yeah.
Because, you had the Crash Bandicoot trilogy and then Crash Team Team Racing, and then they handed it off. Jak and Daxter Trilogy, Jak X, and then they handed it off. Uncharted 3, and they didn't do Uncharted Racing, but then they did do Lost Legacy and then Uncharted 4, and that was the break in the cycles. Oh, we can make this go longer. And there's obviously rumors of another Uncharted. And then Last of Us, they haven't done... I would actually take Last of Us Racing at this point.
Wow.
But, as a fun kart racer thing. But my overall point is that like it never felt like it could follow that... that wider model, but it because of just the reality of the first game story, but now it's this much bigger thing.
Yeah.
And like Last of Us Factions, the multiplayer, based on the leaks, was going to be a handful of people living in a mansion. They would go out on different missions, and then you would take part in those battles, and that would be the multiplayer. And it's just that a thing, like, oh, it can be as malleable as something like The Walking Dead. And I kind of see Sony go... okay, there's a big gap in the market for zombie media.
Yes.
Because Walking Dead's been failing for quite a while, or it's not been anywhere near as strong, and then capitalizing on that. And for the most part, people have responded to that.
Absolutely.
It's just weird watching it, because I'm like, to me, Last of Us is almost an indie movie or an indie game. Like, it's in terms of the tone and the story being told and the reality of the feel of going through it, I never thought it would be as big as this.
No, here's the funny thing. So was Iron Man. You know what I mean? That was like an independent movie when that was made.
I know.
It's strange to think, isn't it? Like, it was. I was reading a book recently called The Rise of the MCU that went into the production of all of the movies, and it was funny because everyone on set was like, this is like the most ambitious indie movie ever made, because it was independently funded, it was independently made, it had a distributor eventually, but like it was a similar thing of like, it's this big thing, but it kind of has that indie feel, and in the MCU's case had this indie feel, and that went on to be like the biggest thing in the entire world.
True.
And I kind of look at the two trajectories and notice similarities in that way, because obviously The Last of Us wasn't indie in terms of its production, but it did feel like, you know, they were taking a risk. They were doing something against the grain in a little way. And, you know, Neil Druckmann's gone on record saying that this was his dream game, and he thought, like, he'll get to make this one, and then it probably will sell okay, but it won't become a franchise, like you were saying. So now to see it evolve into this huge multimedia thing, it's exciting, but it's also worrying, because I don't want to see infinite Last of Us games. I don't want to see infinite Last of Us shows or spin-offs or whatever. I want to see more, but I want Naughty Dog to be able to kill it. I want at least to see them finish Ellie, Joel, and Abby's stories. Mm-hmm. Finish that arc. And then, if you want to make spin-offs with other teams, if you want to explore the world is vibrant enough. There's so much potential within that. But I don't want to be sat here in 15 years' time and be talking about The Last of Us 6 and we're still following, like, Ellie, you know? I kind of want the ability to see it finish, because that's a mistake the MCU hasn't done.
Yeah, and it's like that Iron Man thing is interesting in terms of the approach, like the idea that maybe we don't know if this is going to go any bigger, but I guess like at least Iron Man was always part of Marvel. It was always in a wider framework anyway. Like there were things to pull from, whereas Last of Us felt like its own, like on an island kind of thing. Yeah. And it was because of that, it was, to me, it was why Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley stuck out so much. And then they were given the keys to Uncharted, and then they nailed that with Uncharted 4. And then Bruce Straley was like, oh, I'm kind of done. I've done a lot of games in a row and I'm going to go on a sabbatical. And he's had various things to say about the reality of The Last of Us now, and the way Naughty Dog's gone, and how much he's been paid and how much he's been accredited, because now Last of Us is thought of as Neil Druckmann's thing.
Yeah.
When it seems like Straley was always involved in it from the very beginning. That's a whole other interesting thing to sort of pick apart. I think it's just, I need to let it go. I kind of realized this like over the last few years anyway. I was like, it's not what I thought it was. You can argue the planning stages or whatever, but like it isn't for me anymore, and that's fine. But it's like when you look at the various parts of it, like the Last of Us 2 remastered and like doing that again, like doing another remaster only 3 years after the original, and then throwing together various parts that are fun, like No Return and the roguelike mode and like putting in the guitar mode and whatever, they're fine. But I can't help but shrug and be like, you are stretching this so thin.
Right.
And it's just like you've had like three remasters of Last of Us 1, or like three versions of Last of Us 1, the original, the PS4 version, the PS5 version, two versions of Last of Us 2. And it's like, but across 10 years, but we've got all these things coming out of it. It just feels very stretched thin. And I kind of want a bit more to the overall meat of that core strand to it before we start, going even wider.
I think I'll give you that, to be fair. You know, I think I do agree that, I would, in terms of video games, like it to go away a little bit, because like I said, I appreciate that they haven't rushed out a true sequel, but I do have to concede that, it's not like Sony haven't been lacking in Last of Us releases through the remakes, through the remasters that you mentioned, through like those add-ons, through greenlighting The Last of Us Factions. They've definitely been trying to keep the franchise as a whole in Sony fans' minds and in players' minds. And yeah, I don't really need all of those reiterations of the games, because I think for me, The Last of Us Part 2 was so impactful and so exciting a project because we did have that big gap, like you said. And yeah, we had the remaster, but that came 1 year after the original game. And then it was pretty much radio silence until they announced the sequel, and then it was like a drip feed of information. It wasn't this constant like it kind of is now, where you always
the faucet is open.
Something to look forward to, or something to play, or a new version, or a new iteration, or they're dabbling around in it. You know,
I think it's interesting as well if we pivot into like the TV show and like that other sort of version of The Last of Us that's come up, like Bella Ramsey and Pedro Pascal, like are arguably just as valid as Troy Baker and Ashley Johnson's versions in terms of the amount of eyeballs that like probably more people have seen, well, they will have done, seen the TV show than the games. Or at least it'll be up there. So yeah, we got our season two castings. We've got Caitlin Dever as Abby, Isabella Marced as Dina, and Young Mazzino as Jesse. Now, I only know Caitlin Dever as an actor, and I only know Young Mazzino was in Beef. He was the brother in Beef.
Yeah.
And he's like, he's awesome. I don't know Isabella Marced as Dina, but I guess thoughts on the castings, because for me, like, I hope it'd be really awesome to see if Caitlin Dever gets huge.
Right, yeah.
She could do that for, like, latter-day Abby or whatever. But, like, she's a phenomenal actor, though.
She
it's like,
is.
I trust her to do Abby justice kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm only familiar with Caitlin Dever, but I think it is funny that, you know, at one point she literally was, I'm pretty sure it did a script reading for the Last of Us movie that was eventually cancelled. She was cast as Ellie then, and then when it came around to doing the TV show, I remember the creatives saying, oh, she got a bit too old, like she couldn't play a 14-year-old convincingly. So I think it's almost perfect casting for Abby to have her be like almost this twisted version of Ellie. Or not but a parallel to Ellie.
Yeah.
You know, in the games, that's what she is. They're two sides of the same coin. They're supposed to kind of evoke each other's storylines. They are dealing with similar grief and trauma. Mm. So for me to cast a person that was a fan favorite for Ellie in the first place twistedly works, because you can kind of definitely see her as... you know, in an alternate reality, Ellie, you know, you see her going on that same journey, which is exactly what they try to accomplish with Abby in the game, where you think in another world, she could have been Ellie in part one. You could have played as her in the first game and had a similar story, right? So for me, that casting works, and then it also helps, like, yeah, like you said, everything I've seen her in, which admittedly isn't loads, but it is a few good projects. She's been really good in them.
Yeah, in terms of like what they're going to do for season two as well, like there was a whole thing, I forget exactly who said it, whether it was Craig Mazin, one of the showrunners, or Neil Druckmann, but talking about, you know, that idea of having to plan like further ahead kind of thing, because they don't have that much main story to pull from. And I was just wondering, like, that idea of casting Caitlin Dever, and a lot of the side-by-side screenshots that have done the rounds are, like, young Abby when she wasn't jacked, like, before the horrible thing happens and she turns her body into a weapon and everything. And I wonder if that is season two. I wonder if you just flesh out, like, the reality of her living situation. You flesh out the father and you do that kind of stuff. And you maybe don't have that until right at the end. Because obviously the event impacts Pedro Pascal and everything else.
Yeah.
So it's like, I wonder how fast we get there with that, and whether you flesh out what is the beginning of The Last of Us 2, the game.
Yeah.
Maybe make a whole season out of that.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting, because, you know, I think a lot of people were saying after season one aired, like, will we get, you know, an interim season, you know, cover Ellie and Joel's time immediately after the first game to the point where we pick up The Last of Us Part 2. But the casting of Abby maybe throws that out the window. But like you said, you know, we could be seeing her as well before the events of Part 2. We don't know. Will she be playing a little bit younger than the Abby we see in the main game? I don't know. I wonder how much the casting, you mentioned her getting buff. Obviously, Abby is defined by her physicality. I wonder whether Caitlin Dever was a good cast because, you know, Bella Ramsey, they're a great actor and they're getting buff right now. You know, they've released the training videos of them, you know, going through that rigorous training to get strong. But they're small in stature. You know, they convincingly played a 14-year-old. So I wonder whether Caitlin Dever won't be getting that buff, so you can have that more, not convincing rivalry, but more grounded rivalry. I imagine they're both going to get incredibly strong. I imagine they're going to go through a lot of training each. But I wonder whether, you know, I mean, in the first season, Joel was a shadow of his form, of his video game self in terms of physicality. You know, they make a big point about him being unable to hear on one side. You know, he's taken a bunch of blows. He can't walk right. His hip isn't working. You know, he's not BM. He's capable of those monstrous moments where he just is overcome by physicality, but it's more, you know, realistic in a sense. And I think that's very much from Craig Mazin, who is trying to double down on that. So I wonder if they're doing something here where they're not going for the exaggerated physicality, because it might look a bit too strange against Bella Ramsey's kind of figure, and they kind of go more equals, which again makes sense for the Caitlyn Dever casting, because she was going to be Ellie, so it kind of makes sense to make them parallels in that way.
I always really loved in Last of Us 2 how you had like Ellie sort of internalized everything, and she was quite gaunt, and like her arms were very, very thin, and in terms of how she was processing everything that happened. I'm steering clear of spoilers because I wonder how many people are coming into Last of Us 2 fresh now that the remaster's out. So I'll not be too specific about the events of that game, even though it is a few years old. But obviously something happens at the beginning of Last of Us 2, and she very much internalizes it. And then, you know, very much the same kind of thing happens with Abby involved, or something else happens with Abby involved, and she turns her entire body into a weapon. And I always love the like both sides of the coin to that.
Yeah.
Like as inward as Ellie goes is as outward as Abby goes. And I think I always loved that. I hardly see anybody talking about that.
Yeah.
As to why Abby is so big, like you would never mess with her after what happened, versus the way that she was beforehand. And like, yeah, I wonder how much that on the Druckmann side, the Craig Mazin side, how much that's fundamental to the character, when they almost reimagine them kind of thing, when they have to recast them again.
Yeah.
Do you need Abby's physicality, or can't you still, you know, maybe learn a martial art or something, or like do something where you still wouldn't mess with her? Because Caitlyn Dever, I was just Googling the name. I forgot the name of the thing I loved her in. It was Unbelievable from 2019. That's what I'd recommend the most if you want to just look at how incredible she is on screen. But yeah, like obviously she's got a hell of a range. Like she was in Booksmart as well. And that No One Will Save You movie, which I think she carries.
I've not seen that one actually.
It's, I watched that because Guillermo del Toro tweeted about it.
Right.
And he was like, oh, it's very suspenseful, very full of surprises the whole way through. And once you get all the way to the end, it's like, I liked it overall, but I was like, okay.
Interesting.
Sure. But my point is that Dever has a lot of range, and like, there's maybe a way to do physical intimidation that isn't just muscles.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want it to sound like I'm, you know, saying that they shouldn't do muscular, big Abby. Like, of course, they absolutely can. I think it would still work. I was just kind of, you know, playing devil's advocate almost and thinking about the casting and wondering if they're going to go down that route just because of the way they treated Joel in the original. But if Caitlyn Dever does get huge for it, like I'm absolutely here for that, because like you said, you know, Abby's physicality at the very least is so important to her character, and the way that she deals with her grief and her trauma and her past, and how she displays that with her body, and like you said, in a way that Ellie sort of internalizes her. I think that is a really interesting parallel. But Dever, just judging from what I know of the actress and the role she's been in before, you know, it's Abby's going to be a difficult role, you know, regardless of the fact. But hopefully, I do think she has the range, like you said, looking at something like Booksmart, where she can play very endearing and very likable and very funny against something as intense as Unbelievable. You know, I hope that she's able to bring the humanity that Abby needs, whilst also keeping that edge and hostility and threat that, of course, the character needs as well. You know, it is a tough role to get right.
Yeah, Last of Us as a TV show, I thought had like such an all over the place kind of tone as well. Like, I wasn't like huge on it overall, but like I'm curious how much things get cranked up in season two. Like Last of Us 2, the game is such a like foot to the floor. We're gonna fully go into, like you said, it's all about hate in terms of the messaging of it and Neil Druckmann's overall mission statement for it, and how much Last of Us the TV show part two, whether that is also about hate, and whether all that also makes that really just steers all the way into the darkest aspects of humanity and minimizes the light kind of thing. I'm like, I'm curious what Last of Us season two ends up feeling like. For now, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you, and we'll catch you very soon.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.